We finished the chapter on the basic equations last time. So now we essentially know the types of equations that we want to solve, or that might be sort of interest in computational fluid dynamics. And now we really want to focus on essentially the numerical methods to try and solve them. And so this chapter will be on finite differencing methods. Some of these methods will actually not be used or typically not used for computational fluid dynamics. I have to be honest with you, but they will be of use for those of you who are interested in, for example, the Einstein equations or some other problems that involve PDEs, and where essentially finite differencing methods are sort of a good technique to apply. It turns out that for conservation laws, those methods are not very well suited for reasons that we'll discuss and that will become obvious over the next couple of lectures and also later on in this course. But I do have to introduce them here because what we will eventually be interested in are finite volume schemes. In order to understand essentially those so-called conservative schemes that preserve the conservation law nature on the discretized level. So the conservation law nature on the analytical level, we also want that to be preserved on the discretized numerical level. And those so-called conservative schemes will be sort of the schemes of interest to us and the associated finite volume methods. And they are obviously based on some notions that come with finite differencing methods. And so this is why I would like to introduce some very basic concepts here. Some of you who are working on, for example, the Einstein equations and some problems in GR on the numerical level will be familiar with probably some of the basic concepts here, but maybe there's also new aspects for you to discover here. So let me start just by painting essentially the very basic picture here. The essentially very basic picture of discretization. And so the very basic problem that we have when we sort of want to start solving equations on a discretized level is the following. So we have a continuous problem. So the level of the actual partial differential equation. So we have some problem where we map some function U essentially to its solution of the, so if U is essentially the solution of a partial differential equation, we map here U to, so here's the differential operator. And so X and Y are just some sort of function spaces, and so that those depend on exactly the essentially the type of solution that we are interested in. So you can think of essentially sort of, for example, X would be sort of the space of, let me write this down, put it down here. So for example, X would be essentially all sort of twice differentiable function, so U that I have continuous, these have two derivatives and are continuous. And also we assume that essentially the, if we plug, so if we apply the differential operator, that essentially everything will stay bounded to make the problem sort of well posed. And so essentially what we have on the discretized level then is that what we are actually looking at when we try to solve this with a computer is we apply some sort of discretization operator to the problem. So actually we're looking at a discretized problem between sort of these discretized function spaces, if you want. So there's some discretization operator DH. So let me just write this down. So the continuum problem is sort of LU equals some source term on the right-hand side S. So this is our continuum PDE. And so some examples would be, some of which we've already discussed, could have the Laplacian here, or the wave equation, or for example, we could have our conservation laws here. So this would be some function, some conservative form here of our conservation law, and so on and so forth. And so the discretized problem will be some discretized differential operator acting on some discretized function equals some sort of discretized version of our source terms. So this is our discretized problem. And so typically, those functions that we, these discretized functions that we look at here are what we call grid functions. So this would be essentially the set of grid functions, if you want. So essentially, all functions, say V, let's denote them by V, that map from some discretized space onto some real values in Rn. And so this omega H is what we would call the grid. And so for example, this would be, if you want to write this down in a sort of more mathematical form, this would be essentially a section of sort of the domain of the continuous problem with some grid that is characterized but is a grid discretization parameter H. Okay, and so in principle, let me just try to illustrate this here briefly. So let's say we have a problem in our tool, and say we have problem formulated on some domain omega here. So the continuous problem would be defined on this domain. Then we would have to start and discretize this. And so we could put here sort of a regular grid on top, on which we define the discretized problem. And so this grid size would be essentially parameterized by this discretization parameter H. And so just for notation, so sort of all values x in omega on the discretized level then are mapped essentially to some xi. And then we have time that is discretized by some other index that we label n, tn. So essentially some discretized set of times, and here some discretized version. Points in space. And so this discretization parameter, or say operator in this case, dhx, that essentially maps the continuous problem to the discretized problem, as I said, is a mapping essentially between these function spaces, the continuous functions, to some discretized version of these functions. And so there's obviously different choices here that one can make. So I'll just call these UH for now. And there's obviously so various ways of how to do this discretization. And this is usually crucial aspect, obviously. So just I'll just give here two sort of brief examples to illustrate the different choices one could make. So for example, the easiest thing to do would be just to restrict the function onto the values on the grid. So essentially we just project the continuous function onto these discretized values. So in other words, this grid function at some position, at some spatial position I and some temporal position n, some time tn, would just be defined by the continuous function evaluated at xi and tn. And this is typically what one would call, so this is typically the discretization operation that one does for finite differencing methods. So restrictions of this type lead to finite differencing methods. Okay, but one could also take a completely different approach and say, what if we sort of average this function over some control volume? So one could define the value to be 1 over delta x. And then so we apply some spatial averaging here, for example. So we just restrict the time, the function here in the time domain, but we keep essentially the continuous nature in the spatial domain, and we just integrate over some control volume delta x. So cross delta x. And so discretization operations of this type lead to finite volume methods. And it will turn out that we will actually have to apply operations of this type to deal with conservation laws numerically. So just to briefly illustrate this, maybe I have just formulated this in a overcomplicated way, but the difference here really is, so if we have, say, a one-dimensional function u of x, say, then we discretize our spatial domain here. That would be our grid omega h. And so to discretize the continuous function, we could either just restrict it to the values at these given grid points here. So this would be the restriction. Or we could apply averages. Oh, okay, well, so this is not exactly. Okay, I've not drawn this perfectly here, but you get the idea. So those would be essentially the values according to the second method. Where these positions here, so they call this xi, then this would be essentially the interface of what one would call a cell in this case, xi plus 1/2. So also for further reference, essentially this notation, which you'll find everywhere in the literature, is just saying that essentially just go half a separation step to the neighboring grid points. So with essentially h, in this case being delta x. Okay, so this is essentially the very basic setup. And what we will deal with a lot sort of over the next few lectures, and essentially this is a basic question that we will be asking throughout the course until the end, is the following. So if we discretize this continuous problem, we get a discretized problem. And the big question will be, to what extent does such a discretized problem actually provide us with a solution that is representative of the physical solution of the continuous problem that we're actually interested in? Because we are actually interested in the physics of the continuous problem, and so this is what we want to solve. But the only way we can do this numerically is by solving some discretized version. And it is by no means clear or obvious that any solution to the discretized problem would actually properly approximate the continuous problem. And so this is the fundamental problem, essentially, in numerical analysis, is to study to which extent discretized versions and discretized solutions actually approximate and actually converge to the continuous solution. Okay, so that said, let's try and actually discretize continuous equations. So let's start with some finite difference approximations here. And as I said, there's essentially two steps. So one step is to essentially define grid functions and to define discretized versions of functions on your discretized domain. And the second task is also that we need to discretize the differential operators of the partial differential equation. And this is essentially what I would like to discuss now. So again, for notation, what we will be looking at now that we discretize a PDE is that usually we have some time and some space, spatial domain. And so as I mentioned, we label the discretization in time by n. And let's use the index I for labeling the spatial grid points. So this essentially gives us this grid. Okay. And so we can define, we will see in the following, you know, different notations. And so I just wanted to make sure that this is properly defined before it leads to confusion. So this should be I. So this would be UIN, for example, where here we follow finite differencing. So we just restrict the function onto the grid. We're not applying any averages or anything like that. And then sort of so this point here, for example, would be ui minus 1 and then n plus 1/2. So you can also have staggered grid points. So this is what we would call staggered grid points in time. Or, you know, another example up here, say ui plus 1 and then this n plus 1 plus 1/2, which is 3/2. So we can have all sorts of labeling like this. And so we'll make use actually of these staggered grid points because it'll turn out that the accuracy with which we can discretize operators will depend also on the choice of our stencils, so of the exact locations of grid points that we choose for that approximation. So with these essentially basic notation definitions, let's look at some partial derivatives and how to discretize them. And so it turns out we can consider Taylor expansions of our grid function U to easily write down approximations to partial derivatives. So let's look at the following Taylor expansion. So you can write down U at grid point xi plus 1 in terms of the grid point the value of u at the grid point xi. In terms of this Taylor expansion, so 1/2, and then we have the second derivative at grid point I times delta x squared, plus higher order terms. So those would be of the order of delta x cube. And so with this Taylor expansion, we can simply solve for the first order derivative. And so we find that this first order derivative at grid point I can be expressed as ui plus 1, so I and time dn. Again, plus higher order terms. And so if we don't want to be obsessively accurate, we could just now write down a first approximation for the partial derivative, for the first first order partial derivative, and say approximately this is just given by taking the difference of the function at u at xi plus 1 and xi and divided by the grid spacing delta x. And obviously there will be higher order terms here that we neglect for now. And so this would give us already a first approximation for how to numerically compute the first order derivative. So this is usually what's called forward difference approximation. And here, so this is essentially the operator that I defined, where this number here tells us we usually call the stencil size. That is the number of neighboring grid points that are involved to compute the derivative or to compute whatever sort of differential operator we're looking at. So here, in addition to ui, we also need this grid point ui plus 1. So this is why it's called forward differencing. We need one other function value at the neighboring grid point. And so then typically what one would look at when defining such discretized operators is the so-called truncation error, or the accuracy, which is simply defined as the discretized expression minus the actual value, minus the actual value of the corresponding continuous operator on that function. And so from above, so from this relation up here, we know that this is given by 1/2, and then the second continuous derivative evaluated at the grid point xi times delta x plus o terms of higher order in delta x. So you see here that this is what we would call a first order accurate discretization of this operator, of the first derivative. So similarly, we could have derived a different expression, namely by taking by looking at the grid point xi minus 1 instead of xi plus 1. And so this is Okay, let me just highlight this here. So this is forward. And now we're looking at backward differencing. So this would have been derived in an analogous way, just writing down the Taylor expansion here in terms of xi minus one. And so we would have gotten this expression, backward difference approximation. And again, for the same reason, this would be again the first order accurate discretization of this operator. Now we can try and do better and devise operators that are more that have higher accuracy, so that are at least of second order or higher. And so let me just give you an example. Sorry, oops. Operators, and it turns out that if we take center differences, then we'll automatically get one higher order in accuracy. So this will be second order accurate. So let's see. So we can do, for example, the following. So let's write down Taylor expansions for forward and backward discretization. Let's go just half a step in one direction. So delta x, one half delta x. Plus higher order terms. Let's write down the same for the backward discretization. And so if we subtract one from the other, we can solve again for partial u x, at this grid point xi. And so we'll find that So actually,
Daniel, how are those still equal? Would it not be I plus 1/2 in the forward?
Sorry, say again.
If we're, so in the Taylor series, if we're plugging in delta x over 2, would that not be taking us to un of I plus 1/2 and not un of I plus 1?
Yes, sorry, you're right. I should have. Yeah, I wanted to do some simplifications here on the fly because I realized that in my notes I had done this problem a little more complicated and it's probably overcomplicated, and so divided by delta x, and then we see that these error terms here.
Sorry, Daniel, wouldn't it be a minus sign on the numerator?
Yes, you're right. Sorry. And so then essentially the point was here to cancel these first order error terms. So these ones here, and so we end up with higher order terms that are of order delta x squared. So that was essentially the trick to take two Taylor expansions, one forward, one backward. We subtract them from each other, so the first order error terms cancel, and we end up with what we call a center difference operator that is now of order, that is now of second order accuracy. So this is, let me denote this by and so this is now second order accurate. And again, it only just involves, again, sort of neighboring points. Still essentially the stencil width is still essentially 1 if you want. So one crucial remark is obviously that in doing this, we are making use of Taylor series, right? So we are assuming that these functions can actually have derivatives, and we can actually compute those derivatives. And so that is a really crucial sort of fundamental property or assumption for finite differencing schemes, that we always assume the solution to be differentiable. And let me write this down. This is sort of one crucial assumption of finite differencing schemes, and this is exactly also why or part of the reason why we will not be able to just use the straightforward finite differencing approximations for conservation laws, where nonlinearities will lead to shock formation. And so we'll show in a few lectures from now that even under very simple initial conditions, these nonlinearities will arise and will give rise to discontinuous solutions. So these sort of classical smooth solutions only exist locally. And in a finite time step, you can get into the regime where nonlinearities take over essentially and lead to discontinuous solutions, where these derivatives are not defined anymore. Okay, so this was essentially first order derivatives, but sometimes we are also interested, obviously, in higher order derivatives. So how do we get higher order derivatives?
Daniel, can I ask something before you move on?
Yes.
So it's going to be a really practical question. So, so in practice, when you do computation, you know, you have to choose a delta x.
Yes.
And you know, forget about mesh refinement or anything like that. You choose your delta x given, you know, computing resources, given how much time you have at your disposal, and you try to make it as small as you can given the constraints, you know, like time and memory and all of that. Mm-hmm. But suppose you're not constrained by any of this and you're thinking of picking delta x to be as small as you wish, you're still limited by machine accuracy, right? How many, you know, digits you have at your disposal to represent a real number. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're doing double precision, then it's 10 to minus 16 or something like that.
Right.
So if you go all the way to 10 to minus 16, then you're completely swamped by Randolph error. Mm-hmm. So my question is there a rule of thumb to say, if you want to avoid Randolph error and you have a computation that will require you to do N, you know, steps, what's the smallest delta X you can pick for that calculation?
Oh yeah. So typically what you would do is, you can characterize your Randolph error, and you can compute exactly sort of how much that grows over time if you evolve the system. And then you can also have to characterize all sorts of other errors. So the discretization error that you introduce, and you would then have to evaluate how much sort of that grows over time. And there's various ways of how that error sort of is introduced through discretization of your various operators and so on. And so typically you would then evaluate essentially how much you're sort of always dominated by your truncation error, but sort of typically you try to estimate how much that sort of grows over time, and that depends essentially on your problem, on the exactly on the sort of continuous problem you're looking at and you want to try to solve, but then also on the exact numerical scheme that you use to solve it, and so that very much depends on exactly the scheme you use. So you have to essentially evaluate that on a case by case basis. I don't know if that roughly answers your question or.
Right. So I mean, it sort of confirms what I thought, which is that it's problem dependent and probably too hard to do in practice. So you would just try to get it smaller, and until, you know, well, I mean, I guess you're never really encountering that limit, right? In practice.
Yes, in practice not, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so, but there's not like a general rule of thumb, at least I'm not aware of any anything like that. So it really depends on your problem and on the exact scheme you use.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions so far? Or I move on. Okay, so sort of one really straightforward way of going about this is obviously just to repeatedly apply discretizations of the first order derivative. So for example, one possible discretization for the second order derivative would be just to, for example, take a backward finite difference operator and then apply the forward one. So this would be this expression here. And so you can plug in the definitions from above and we just find this expression, for example. I'll call the 2u for now. And so it turns out you can do it in various different other ways. For example, these two actually sort of commute. So you would get the same expression if you would just first apply the forward difference and then the backward difference, for example. That would all sort of lead to the same expression. In general, there is a sort of a straightforward way to compute higher order derivatives of any order given a certain number of grid points, so given a certain number, a certain stencil size. So essentially what we want is, compute this kth derivative based on some number n of stencil points. So using the function evaluated on the set of points x1 to xn, say. So I'll just do this here for a specific example, and then I'll show you how the general recipe is, or just write it down, and you can actually read up more on this in the notes. So I've written given some more detail there. I won't go through this in the interest of time, and that would probably be also too sort of confusing and right now. But in case if you're interested, you can look it up there and get some more detail. So for example, let's say we want the one-sided approximation. So say only taking grid points to the right of, so say if we're at grid point xi and we only want to use essentially grid points to the left of that point, so xi minus 1, xi minus 2. ui minus 2. Then again, what we can do is we can simply write down n Taylor expansions and then use essentially, as I did in the case of the center differences, remember, we can here use n Taylor expansions essentially and try to linearly combine those equations to get an expression for this operator. So this is exactly what we'll try to do now. So let's evaluate, approximate the function at ui minus 1. Then we have here the first order derivative. So I'm now indexing the order of the derivative here with these parentheses on top. Oops. So this would be third order terms, delta x cube plus even higher orders. And now we can do the same thing for I minus 2. Again, here we have the first order derivative plus 1/2. U2 I delta x, 2 delta x squared minus 1/6 u on the derivative I 2 delta x cube plus higher order terms. And so we can now take some linear combination of these equations and make the following ansatz that say the second order derivative at I in terms can be written as a linear combination, some factor C1 times the grid point at ui plus C2 at ui minus 1 plus C3 at ui minus 2. And so if we now plug in the expressions here, so these Taylor series here, expressions for ui minus 1 and ui minus 2, we can write this in the following way. So it's where we're C1 plus C2 plus C3 ui minus C2 plus 2C3 delta x first order derivative plus 1/2 C2 plus 4 C3 delta x squared second derivative minus 1/6 C2 plus 8 C3. And then we have delta x cube and third derivative plus higher terms. And so essentially you can now already guess what the general expression for these coefficients here is. So this would be sort of the general expression. So what we want to do is So this is just essentially a side remark, not too important for now. So what we essentially want to do is that we want this relation to agree with the first order derivative here to the sort of highest order possible. So first we have to make sure that this part here sort of vanishes. So we have to set this to zero. We want that this part here is so that all of this here equals one, so that we get our first order derivative. And then what we can also do is try to set this to zero here so that we only have higher order terms that will be of order delta x squared in the end. So in other words, just write this down. So we can now demand these three conditions here. Okay, and we can solve the system. This is fairly simple. And then C3. And so plugging this back into the original ansatz, we end up with an expression. So we derived an expression now for the second derivative in terms of these one-sided points using the nearest neighbor and the second neighbor. So u I minus one and u I minus two. So this would be essentially the expression that we find following this this method. And the truncation error is now second order. So the term that remains is that we were able to cancel off this term here, but what remains is still this term here. And so this is minus 1/6 C2 plus 8. C3 delta x cube u 3 I and so on plus higher order terms. And so plugging in the expression for C2 and C3, we find that this is 1 minus 1/3 delta x squared u3 ui plus higher order terms. So effectively, this is second order accurate. And so maybe just to point this out, maybe I was not very clear with regard to Eric's question earlier. So the point is always that we know exactly how the error scales with delta x. So we know that as we sort of vary delta x, the error sort of scales with a particular power p, which in this case is 2. But what we usually don't know is exactly what the prefactor of this error is. So in order to know the absolute sort of level, the absolute value of the discretization error, we would need to know this coefficient. And this is usually what we don't know. So this is why if you want to compare the absolute value of a truncation error to the absolute value of, say, a roundoff error given n time steps or so, you would always have to resort to numerical experiment and sort of numerically determine this prefactor that you have by doing some of these scaling analyses and see how the absolute error essentially changes with delta x and what this prefactor is. Okay. And so you can sort of, this was sort of one basic example. You can sort of generalize this procedure and so say, if you specify any stencil, meaning any set of points at which you want to evaluate the function or where you know the value of the function, say around some grid point xi, and you require n to be greater or equal than k plus 1, you can take you can write down again n such Taylor series expressions do a linear combinations of those, solve a system of essentially invert a matrix, solve a system, a linear system, compute your coefficients, and obtain an expression for this kth derivative given whatever stencil essentially you specified, and you will end up with an expression that is accurate to order p, where p is n minus k. And if you want to see essentially the general scheme of how to do this, have a look at the notes. I've sort of written it down there explicitly. I won't go through it here because it's just a lot of writing and probably doesn't help much to understand the
I'm trying to understand, is this a unique prescription?
Yes, so it depends on your stencil size. So you need at least, so if the stencil is exactly k plus one, then there's a unique solution. If you specify more equations, then it is not. And there can be different solutions to that. So in general, if you add, what you can do is then, if you add more, if you add more stencil points, you can require, you can become higher order accurate. So you can specify additional constraints so that higher order terms cancel or set to zero. So essentially just adding more points to your stencil means you can require more error terms to vanish, which means that your scheme becomes higher order accurate. So maybe
I guess what gets me confused is that if you, I mean, in your example, for example, you chose to be one-sided, mm-hmm. but if you had chosen to be double-sided, you could have gotten more accuracy from the same yes. number of stencil points.
Yes, exactly. So this is right. That is right. So if you can get, okay, let me write this down. So you can get higher accuracy, so P greater than N minus K. If you choose your stencil, so the points you want to take into consideration in such a clever manner that higher order error terms just cancel, additionally cancel. So this would be, if you take centered, as Eric mentioned, centered differences.
All right, so the point is that N minus K is the minimum accuracy.
Exactly, so this is the minimum accuracy. But sort of given the set of points that you choose beforehand, there is a unique sort of solution. But you have the freedom, obviously, to choose them. So. You choose them wisely, you can get higher order accuracy. So if you center them on the point where you want to evaluate your whatever partial operator, differential operator you have, right?
Okay. So what I was missing is that, so choosing the stencil is not just choosing the number of points, it's choosing the placements.
Exactly. So exactly. Thank you. It's choosing the placements around the point where you actually want to get an approximation for this discretized version of the differential operator.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And so also what you can see here is obviously it scales with N, right? So if you choose things wisely, then increasing the stencil size increases accuracy. So this is sort of also one general takeaway point here. Okay, any more questions here? Okay, if not, then let's move on. So now that we know how to essentially discretize derivatives, we can actually now look at the discretized version of a PDE. And so essentially, you'll find more examples in the notes. So in the interest of time, I will actually only go through one example here. There will be more for you to explore on the next problem set, so on the third problem set. But I think the sort of most relevant example is if we apply this to the advection equation. Would be sort of a linear version of a conservation law. So let's look at the 1D. Convection equation. So UT, so in one spatial dimension, and we are not looking at the system here, just the scalar equation. And let's say we have some initial data. Well, in principle, we don't need this. So, but I was explicitly writing this down here in terms of spatial domains here between 0 and 1. But we don't strictly need the initial boundary value problem here, just initial value problem is fine too. So let's try to just apply some of these very basic steps to discretize the derivatives here. So one straightforward choice we could make is the following one. So-called forward in time. Centered in space. FDA, finite differencing approximation. So you would write down the first spatial derivative, the spatial derivative as ui plus 1 n minus ui minus 1 n. So this is now, instead of the example that I did before with 1 half delta x, now just doing plus and minus delta x. So we divide by 2 delta x here. And then the time derivative is just a forward difference approximation. So again, remember this is ui, and then here we take n plus 1 minus ui at time tn divided by delta t. So in other words, our stencil looks like the following. So this is I minus 1 plus 1. Oops. And here's the center of our stencil. The center point of our scheme here. Okay, so if we plug this in to our equation, then obviously we find the following ui n plus 1 minus ui n over delta t, the time derivative plus a times the spatial derivative, so a divided by 2 delta x, and then ui plus 1 n minus terms of ui, you can solve for ui n plus 1. So for the advanced value of the function u at xi, advanced by 1 time step, minus a delta t over 2 delta x. So I've just sorted this in a way such that sort of all the advanced time step points are on the left-hand side of the equation, and all the values of the function evaluated at the present time step tn are on the right-hand side. And so if we essentially write this down for all grid points, for all I, we end up with the following linear system. So essentially we have, write this down as some matrix A times a vector un plus one that contains the function at every spatial step xi equals b in this form, where here we have a diagonal matrix one and zero otherwise. And so here we have un plus one at xi equals one to and then here on the right hand side, you have essentially a vector that we can write in this way. So here just should be the set, so x one to xi. So this is sort of characterizes our spatial domain here. And so this is what we would call an explicit scheme. So the matrix here is actually in diagonal form. We can directly obtain the function values at the next time step, at the advanced time step, by some function values given at the present time step. For implicit, so-called implicit schemes, those would be coupled. And so our matrix here would, for example, not be diagonal. So we could have chosen a different time discretization, for example, that would have involved also previous time steps. So here we've just chosen the forward in time that gave us this explicit scheme. Essentially, we could have chosen a different time discretization operator here. And so this could have led us to a non-diagonal matrix, for example, and that is what we would have called an implicit scheme. And so this scheme here, as you remember, so forward in time means that as we've shown above, is first order accurate, so scales as delta t. But we chose centered in space. And as you remember from above, that means that we're accurate as delta x squared. So first order in time, second order in space. And so this is a very simple scheme that one can directly easily write down, and that would be a very straightforward choice in terms of discretizing the 1D advection equation. But we will actually see that this system here, this discretization, is actually not really useful. So we will see that it is in fact unstable. For any combination of delta t and delta x, for any combination of the time and spatial discretization. So what one would actually see in practice here is that if you implemented this in a code, the solution here would be unstable, meaning that it would essentially diverge and your code would crash at some point. So we'll discuss in more detail in the next couple of lectures, what I mean here by stability and under which conditions certain schemes are stable or unstable. So for now, I will just say that sort of this scheme that is very straightforward will actually not work in practice. And sort of interestingly, you can make a tiny modification of the scheme to make it useful. And let me just write this down here. This is something that was proposed long ago by Lux and Friedrichs, so-called Lux-Friedrichs method. So you can make a simple replacement here and replace UI by just the average of UI minus one and UI plus one then. And so essentially the scheme you would get is the following: UI n plus one, it's one half UI plus one n. Minus a delta t divided by 2 delta x. And minus 1 n. So this is a modified scheme. It didn't change the accuracy. So you can still convince yourself that it is the truncation error will be first order in time and second order in space. But the crucial difference is now that if you put this into a computer, that the solution that you compute will be stable under certain conditions, namely when this combination of the advection speed A times delta X divided by delta T divided by delta X is smaller than one. So this is something we'll show in the future. And essentially for now, this is just to say that one has to be very careful in devising numerical schemes. Sometimes the most obvious things don't work, and only sort of making sort of tiny adjustments and sometimes really only very small detailed changes to a numerical method can have actually a big influence in terms of what that method can do. So it can have large consequences for stability and or accuracy. And this is exactly what will lead me next time to discuss the concept of stability. So consistency, stability, and convergence. So this is, again, back to the original question that we started with today, essentially, that the fundamental problem under which conditions, essentially such a discretized version of the equations really approximates the continuous version that we are actually interested in. And so next time, we will discuss some of these concepts that will help us to assess essentially and address this question. So will be these concepts of consistency, stability, and convergence, and so-called Lux theorem. So that will be the topic for next time. And so once we've introduced essentially those notions, we can go back and actually analyze these two schemes that I've written down here, and we will see that they fundamentally differ in these stability properties. And it's really only this tiny change that made all the difference. So that's interesting to see. Any questions? Okay. Good. So, I think this is a good point to stop then. It's exactly 5 p.m. So there's no point in going further. So as I said, next time will be consistency, stability, convergence on Tuesday. Okay, if there are no further questions, then let's stop here.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the evening and see you Tuesday. Yep.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.